This is an ABC podcast.
This is the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, welcome to the Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff. This time last week, I was speaking to you from the Menindee Lakes in the far west of New South Wales. And today, we've hopped in the car and driven about an hour and a half southeast of Adelaide to where the river meets the sea at the town of Goolwa. It's a unique part of the world. And today, I'm joined by Prue Adams, who you'd ordinarily know as a reporter for ABC TV's Landline. But today, she's got her radio headphones on and is ready to tell stories from this special region.
Indeed, I have, Cassie. And there is a lot happening. Goolwa Pippies are taking on the world, and we'll hear more about that. And also see how the lower lakes are faring during this time of low flows and drought in parts of the basin.
Yes, that's all coming up in the next half hour, so do stick around. This is the Country Hour, and it is 6 minutes past 12. If you've been listening into ABC local radio, you would have known that it's a pretty special week for us here. It's the River Lives series, and the Country Hour kicked it off by looking at farming and agriculture in the Menindee Lakes region in the far west of New South Wales. And now we're here at the bottom end of this great Murray-Darling River system. We're at the Goolwa Signal Point Gallery, so if you are in the area, you'd be very welcome to come along. We have the most magnificent view out over the lower Murray. Basically, we can see the last of the fresh water. On the other side of the barrages is where it gets into seawater. So we are at the bottom of the system.
Yep, and in terms of farming, you can't get any closer to the end of the river than Mundu Island Station. Established in 1843, it's the last property before you get to the Murray mouth, the area where the river meets the sea. Colin and Sally Grundy are the fourth generation on Mundu Island Station, although Colin just told me that he's the fifth generation in the region, and Colin's here speaking to me now. So, first of all, Colin, paint a picture of Mundu Island Station, because it's not on just one island, is it?
No, Prue. That's Mundu Island Station is made up of a series of islands which are in the lower lakes before that runs out to sea. So pre-barrage, our family took up Mundu Island and Long Island, Ewe Island, Twitchery, Reedy, and a nest of other little islands. And my grandfather put sheep out there, so they'd row the sheep out in a boat, put them onto these islands for the summer, and row them back. Which was quite an amazing achievement. And you see the old photographs, and they're all done up in three-piece suits, which I find quite amazing. But they were corridales, which must have been quite handy in that sort of country. But it would have been very hard work. And also they did, I think he had milking cows, which were actually shorthorn milking cows. They had ostriches for the feathers for the First World War, I suppose. Pigs, potatoes.
But you don't have any of those?
No. It's just a change in the environment, change as you go along to what grows best in our country now is cattle.
So what sort of cattle?
Angus cattle. We've been Angus since they were kicky little things, probably for 60 years now, close to 60 years we've been growing Angus. They really do well in their swamps. Mm-hmm. They actually graze underwater. You'll see...
Graze underwater?
Well, they don't have snorkels, but they'll they'll put their head down to their eye line and munch on the grass, which is being flooded at the time, if there's a high thing. Where Hereford seem to want to stand up on the bank and whinge and carry on, the Angus get out there and get into it. So they're really suited for this country.
Sound ideal for this part of the world. And you're in an interesting situation in that you have barrages on your property. Mm. So what does that mean? They're separating the salt water from the fresh water, aren't they?
You know, when the lake was used for paddle steamers to get around and irrigation, and everybody around the lake had riparian rights to water. And when irrigation started cutting in early on in the end of the 1800s to the 1900s, the lake level was quite different. It wouldn't be high enough for paddle steamers to go across. So that's when the barrages were first mooted, I suppose. So they built the barrages in the 30s, and that made Lake Alexandrina a permanent height, and then the paddle steamers could navigate, go through the barrages out the sea and on to, for, you know, export and stuff, not to export, but that was a direct way then. And then the barrages were built in the 30s, which actually divided our property with probably one third or probably one quarter on the salt side and three quarters on the fresh side, which changed the whole environment there. And with that, after about 10 years of that fresh water, liver fluke came down the river and really knocked my grandfather around to the fact that he was thinking of selling the property because all the sheep were dying. It was just horrific, and going down the southeast. But my father talked him out of it, and they stayed and then moved into cattle, which seemed to be better at handling liver fluke.
Are you glad you stayed?
Oh, absolutely. This is God's own country.
It really is. On a day like today, when the sun's shining and you've had some rain, and you've had some decent rain.
We have. We had probably one of the driest summers that I can recall. It was just horrific feeding hay, just horrific. And now we've had a great opening rain. We've probably had two and a half inches of rain. The grass is growing. The mushrooms are growing. The cattle are smiling. I'm smiling. Everybody.
I'm even smiling. Smiling along with you.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic.
And so how do you manage them? So they're obviously on the islands part of the time?
Yes. In the summertime, we put all our cows, which would be preg tested, in calf out onto the what we call the swamps or the wetlands, which is all summer growing. So we put everything out there except for our weaners, which we keep on the high ground just to keep control of them, and heifers, which we were mating and first calvers. So we keep those on the high ground, and we try and keep them going with lucerne and hay and stuff like that. So the cows go out there pregnant. We've just finished bringing them in 2 days ago, which was, I dragged them in off the swamps with hay because this time of the year, all the swamps go, they die. It's cold. They stop growing. They go to seed, and the cows are actually looking. Every time it rains, they'll come up onto the high ground, have a look, see if there's anything to eat, then they'll go back in if there's not. So I drag them up onto the high ground with hay. We don't use anything else. We used to have horses and aeroplanes and all that stuff, but now hay seems to work for us. And then we just start rotating around the farm on the high ground. They calve. When they've calved, we wean them, preg test them, then send them out back into the swamps for the summer again.
You've got a few dorpers as well?
We've got a few dorpers, yes.
Much you don't
to
love
my
dorpers,
disgust.
Though, do you?
No, I hate sheep. I'm definitely not a sheep person. They're too smart for me, my uncle told me, which is probably very true.
Well, that doesn't give you a lot of credit if a dorper is too smart for you.
Well, they are. They're incredibly. Dorpers are like little cattle. I don't think they're really related to sheep that much because if you push them too hard, they just stop. They're almost like they're velcroed together. They'll go through every fence on our place, but they hate water. So that's why we've still got them. We're an island.
That's your fence.
That's our fence, yeah.
Now, because of where you live, you're in a really good position to talk about how the end of the river works. And what's happening at the moment? The dredging still, there's dredging in place?
Yeah, but I just want to go back to the dorpers.
Absolutely.
Because even though I hate them, my wife and my two children love them. And they've got pets and they come running up. And we do tours through the property too. And the Chinese and other people just love these animals, which we've bottle fed, you know. And they come running out of the mob and smooch all over these people for nuts and stuff. So everybody loves them.
Well, they are
except
smart,
for me.
Aren't they
are very
get around
smart.
People.
We've actually got one called Bubsy, which I was bottle – or. The kids were bottle feeding with and I was bottle feeding a calf. So it actually thinks it's a cow.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with the sheep at all. It just hangs with the weaners all the time. So the sheep will all walk past and it ignores them. It thinks they're stupid. And I totally agree with him. Bubsy and I are eye to eye.
You and Bubsy are like that, fingers crossed.
Anyway, back to the mouth.
Yeah, just quickly, because we'll run out of time in a moment. Sorry. But no, that's okay. No, I loved hearing about Bubsy. Is the they're still dredging?
Yes, they're dredging all
Why?
The time.
Why do they do that?
Because the mouth blocks up. It's the sand is very fine on the Coorong, which is the sea is really rough. Like the Southern Ocean is a very rough sea. So you've got the Murray Mouth and very fine sand and a rough sea, and which the sand just comes up and sort of almost floats with the stirring of the waves, and that just drifts back in through the mouth. So even though you have a big flow which will scour the mouth, and then when they shut the barrages because there's no more water, this sand just drifts back in again. Every high tide, the sand just comes in. So what you actually need is a constant flow of water rather than a big flood, which is lovely. But you need that river mouth to keep flowing so that it keeps pushing that sand out. And it doesn't have to be a huge flow. It just needs to be a gentle push out to keep that sand going out. That's how I understand it. And if you don't have that, well, then you just have to dredge.
Mm-hmm. So it's something that they'll have to keep on doing, basically.
Yeah, I don't really know if there's a mechanical way, because I've been told that the ocean is just too strong. It's just a massive... You know, there's five or six breakers out there all the time, even on a calm day. And then when you get a storm, it's huge. Back, I think it was in the early 80s that the mouth actually blocked up and they had to open it up. And it went from being just at a low sea level to above the 1956 flood level with sand in one day.
Wow. Goodness.
So if you didn't open it with excavators and stuff, you would have had to have another 1956 flood level to lift it up over that bank that was formed in one day. But if you didn't have that in 2 days, well, then it would be higher again. So so it's an amazing active area, the Murray Mouth.
And I'm sure you've had a lot to watch in your many years here in this area. It must be very interesting seeing it change and evolve all the time.
It's just changing all the time. The mouth actually moves up and back towards Gore, then back towards us. It's probably moved in its time from White Man, you know, probably three mile or something from one side back to the other. It's a constantly evolving area.
Fascinating.
Colin, thank you.
That's all right.
Thanks for coming into the gallery and sitting down and having a chat. We could have talked for ages, I'm sure, for the whole program, perhaps.
I'm a bit of a gas bag, I've been told.
Well, I happen to be as well. And I think Cassie can talk too, so we're a fine trio.
Perhaps we can have
a coffee
afterwards.
Get into radio if you don't like talking. But this is the Country Hour, and it is 17 minutes past 12.
You're listening to the South Australian Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Yes, this is the Country Hour. We're broadcasting live from Goolwa. We're looking out over the bottom end, about as far down the River Murray as you can get. And there's a lot of very niche industries down here, but one industry that's really put Goolwa on the map a little bit is it's become known as the pippy capital of the state. Now, I know pippies is a bit of a controversial term, isn't it, Prue?
Well, would you like me to start asking Tommy about what pippies are?
Well, I think you're saying that they're also called surf clams, but not cockles.
This is the big debate.
We're joined by Tom Robinson. He's the managing director and co-founder of the Pippy Goolwa, the Goolwa Pippy Company. He's with us now, and I guess that's the first cab off the rank. Why do we call them pippies and not cockles?
So we have just started sort of playing around with social media as a company sort of in the last 5 years. And the thing that most people come back with is they say, you know, you're a South Australian, it's a cockle. Everyone calls it a cockle. Why are you calling it Goolwa Pippy Co? And the simple truth is that there are Australian fish standards. And that means that you need to call your species the correct name. And the scientific name of our product is Donax deltoides.
Oh, that's too hard.
So that wasn't going to work.
Than that.
then we have, so we needed to call it the Australian fish standard name, so that's a pippy, but other people call them clams, but all South Australians really know them as cockles. I know it as a cockle, but it doesn't really matter what you call it. It's a clam, and people like fishing with them, and people like eating them. Yeah.
And they were basically just low-value bait, but now they're on the menu of some of the best restaurants. Mm. How did Goolwa Pippi Company come to be involved in getting pippies around the world?
So I joined the fishery in 2002 after spending the first 15 or 16 years of my working career in the advertising industry. And for my sins, I wrote car ads for Mitsubishi, so Magnas and Pajeros and those sorts of things. And after 15 years, I sort of tired of the industry. And my father was involved indirectly through the fishing industry in Port Lincoln. And so I went looking for a fishery that I could afford to enter, because entering fisheries is generally an expensive thing to do. So if you buy the lowest value fishing license you can in South Australia, it also has the lowest value product, because that's why the license is cheaper. And so I worked out very quickly that with others in the fishery who are now my business partners, that we needed to start exploring markets beyond the bait market. And today, 95% of our product is sold as food, much to the disappointment of some recreational fishers, because the pippies they would have otherwise bought as bait are now being sold as a food product in their
own
right.
Too expensive for them to be bait, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
So how much do you produce? What's your production? And then how much is what is the value per kilo at the moment?
So for our food production, the average price at the moment is somewhere between $10 and $12 a kilo. So it's not like an abalone or a rock lobster or anything like that. But when you think, when I entered the fishery, our wholesale price for pippies was about 40 cents a kilo. That is a big change over the journey. It is a market that is still very much developing, and whilst there are lots of people wanting to use the product, it's not a mainstream product. You can now buy it in supermarkets and lots of restaurants, but it's not a mainstream product. So the market can also be very easily oversupplied.
So do you know what the total market is?
So our total fishery this year in South Australia was 650 tonnes. We think in New South Wales there is about another 300 to 400 tonnes that come out of that market. And in Victoria there's a small fishery of about 50 to 60 tonnes. So, and there are also other clam species in Australia, mud cockles and sand cockles and different species, but our cockle or pippy is caught in New South Wales, South Australia and Victoria.
And you're working in a collaboration with the Indigenous community here, the Narangiri people. How did that come about?
A bit like everything else that happened in Goolwa Pippi Co. When I joined the fishery in 2002, the other fishers must have thought, who is this crazy person who comes down and can't fish and wears city clothes and has the hands of a beautician and lucky he's
it's settle down, they're not that good.
So they could have either run me out of town, or I think they were sort of probably more confused about why I was actually down here. And so because I couldn't fish very well, even though I thought I would like to be down there, I think they saw that the industry probably needed someone to bring people who would have otherwise probably worked against each other to start working together. And, we used to drive up and back from the airport all in our individual trucks, all with our freight going to exactly the same place, and, literally wave our fists at each other on the Southern Expressway, cursing us, for sending product up. And we just thought it was an easier, made more sense for us to work together than to work against. And that takes time. I joined the fishery in 2002, but Goolwa Pippi Co. wasn't actually formed until 2014. So there was a courting period that took, 12 years for them to trust me and for me to gain their respect. And so the recent involvement with the Narangiri community is the same. We said, you know, these people have been fishing this resource for 10,000 years. There are pippi middens and cockle middens that you can go and see that, you know, are many, many thousands of years old. And when we were looking to further grow the business, we went and said, well, these people are people who have got real connection with the country. They want to get back there and harvest something that they've been doing for a long time, but at a commercial level. And so we went to join them into the company, and it's just one of those things where, you know, the company has worked together to build something better. Yep.
That sounds fascinating. And you've got a bright future ahead, I understand. You've got some markets lined up overseas and things.
Yeah, so a lot of people talk about the export of our product, but there's as much, well, there's a lot more product development just happening locally in the Australian market. And so, you know, we send only a very small percentage of our catch overseas, but we are growing markets domestically.
And you've got a production plant just up the road at Port Elliot that's vacuum packing.
Yep.
What's that done for your business and for shelf life?
Yeah. So that's just another example of, by working together, we were able to take risks that we wouldn't have been able to do as individuals. So we received a grant and bought the machine to put our pippies into these modified atmosphere bags, which means that instead of just selling it as a loose product at your local fishmonger, we were able to sell it in more mainstream supermarkets and things. So that now represents about a third of our business, and we would expect that to grow over time.
That's fascinating. Good luck with the venture. That was Tom Robinson, who is the Managing Director and co-founder of the Goolwa Pippi Company. And he's been working with the local Indigenous community and people here in the region to really develop what, as we were saying, was just bait and cockles were a dime a dozen, and now they're quite the delicacy around the world, not just here in Australia. But you're listening to the Country Hour. It's we're broadcasting live from Goolwa. We're right at the bottom of the River Murray, and one man who has spent the last 15 odd years looking at this area from an environmental scientist point of view is Associate Professor Luke Mosley. Hi, Luke.
Hi.
So you are the president of Soil Science Australia as well. What initially brought you down here to this part of the world?
Yeah, well, I got a job for the state government here in the Environment Protection Authority, which is the environmental regulator here in South Australia. And my job was really to, I guess, manage risks to water quality in the Lower Lakes, Coorong, and upstream in the River Murray. So I sort of developed, a working relationship, and then really fell in love also with this region and the people. So I was quite passionate about it. And,
it's easy
and
to do, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, it's just a great region. So I found it scientifically interesting and a really great place to work. And I just, I guess, kept doing it since, yeah.
And I must admit, I think I might have even still been in school 15 years ago. And one thing that came up a lot were acid sulfate soils. When we really started looking at the Lower Lakes and this lower end of the Murray and the problems it was facing, that was something that came up a lot. It was largely driven by the drought, I understand, but what is it and why is it such a concern?
Yeah, so in I guess the early 2000s, the River Murray flows were quite low, but then we had a really extreme low flow period between about 2007 to 2010. And what that did was there wasn't enough water basically coming down the river to meet evaporative losses out of the lower lake. So the lake levels started dropping away, and they fell nearly 2 metres. And it's a very shallow lake, so it doesn't sound like much, but that exposed huge areas of lake bed essentially on the edges of the lake margins. And those lake beds contain what we call acid sulfate soil materials. And these are It's a naturally forming mineral called pyrite, which is like the active ingredient in there. And it's normally benign. It just stays underwater and there's no real problems. But what happens when it exposes to oxygen is it can generate acid in firstly the soil. And that can be sort of down below pH 3 to 4, quite typically. So suddenly we had very large areas of lake bed exposed that then acidified to that pH 3 to 4
That's very acidic. What does that do for the water and the environment?
Yeah, well, I mean, the environment was devastating. Just the lake levels falling itself was devastating for the environment, and the salinities really increased in the lake, and also for the community, for the irrigators. So the lake water essentially became too salty to irrigate and too salty for a lot of the freshwater organisms. And that disconnection of all that riparian, all those reeds and things, really created large problems for everything living in and around the lake. In terms of acid sulfate soils, what happened in some large areas quite near here, actually Currency Creek, which is up here, that fully dried out, and then we got some winter rain and a little bit of flow down the creek, and we suddenly had hundreds of hectares of very acidic water that was pH 4, so very large volumes. There were mussel shells, actually. I distinctly remember, it was probably one of my really strong memories of environmental impacts, when I saw these. I came to a site and I saw mussel shells dissolving in the water from the acid. Just, it was so acid.
You could actually watch it dissolve.
Yeah, you could see it fizzing.
Wow.
It was quite shocking for me, even though I'd seen quite a lot by that point as an environmental scientist. And then, that invoked, a large response from the government to respond to that situation.
And we're in another dry time, low inflows. Are you seeing anything similar happening?
Yeah, look, we are in another low inflows, and it's important to note also on the Murray that, you know, low inflows, there's always a human signature now to low inflows. So there's a lot of water extracted upstream and diverted upstream, and we're the most vulnerable part of the Murray, really, here at the bottom end of the river system. And similar in the Darling, where all the fish kills are, that's a very vulnerable part of the river system for the Darling River. So anything that gets basically, you know, water that gets extracted, diverted, reduces the flow downstream. So there's always that signature here. We're getting less flow, as Colin talked about, less flow out the River Murray mouth, and less flow on average, and less high flow events. So while the basin plan is attempting to address that by recovering water for the environment, which is a very positive thing, it's still an ongoing, challenge, particularly at the bottom end of these river systems.
And not just on this side of the barrages, so on the other side, on the ocean side as well.
Yeah, well, that's been quite an interesting, from a scientific perspective as well. I've actually got one of my current PhD students, Hannah Orrick, here at the University of Adelaide, and she's been using satellite imagery to look at all the little plankton in the water off the Murray mouth, and you can get images basically off there of where those plankton are. And what we've done is we've correlated that to river flow. So these are satellites that NASA have just got orbiting the Earth constantly. And as, I guess, the river flow comes down through the Murray-Darling Basin, it picks up nutrients. And if it doesn't make it to the sea, or only a small amount makes it to sea, those nutrients aren't going out to the sea and providing all that food, essentially, for the coastal water and all the plants that live in, and like the pippies that was discussed. So she found that when we had high flows, it was actually a plume, essentially, of productivity in the coastal water out about 60 kilometres, whereas in the drought, it was basically it collapsed to the shoreline. It was just nothing happening out there, and we think that's got some very large effects on, like, the fish and the penguins and the pippies out there, that they're not getting those food sources if we don't get those flows.
It really is a unique ecosystem around here. Just finally, before we go, I understand you've actually, with all your experience, written a book.
Yeah, it's this weighty tome here called
It is, you've brought it in.
Natural History of the Coorong Lower Lakes and Murray Mouth Region, and the Nurrungeri word, the Yalawa Ruwe. So that was, a labour of love. A lot of the scientists, did a lot of projects in this region, and it was, a not-for-profit exercise for the Royal Society of Australia to put together this book. So there's about 25 chapters. It's actually freely available on the internet. If people want to look it up, there's a PDF, and then you can order also hard copies. So we're hoping that just that knowledge, from the scientists and the community doesn't get lost, and we can use that to protect the region into the future.
Absolutely. Great work. Thanks so much for joining us, Luke. That was Luke Mosley. He's the president of Soil Science Australia, who made his way down here to join us for our outside broadcast that's taking place at Goolwa. We'll just touch base with news, though, to find out what's happening across the state. We're joined by Suweba Hanifi. Hi, Suweba.
Good afternoon, Cassie. Making headlines, the Port Pirie Council says it has several projects in mind now that it's been awarded drought funding from the federal government. The funding gives councils $1 million for community projects for upgrades and improving mental health. Port Pirie was previously excluded from the funding because it didn't meet the criteria. A new trial date has been set for a man accused of murdering his disabled wife by throwing her into a pond after a mistrial was declared yesterday. 70-year-old Peter Rex Dancy had been on trial in the Supreme Court for 2 weeks until a mistrial was declared yesterday. His lawyer successfully applied for the trial to be abandoned over comments the judge made about whether or not Mr. Dancy would give evidence in his defence. Prosecutors allege Mr. Dancy pushed his wife Helen, who was in a wheelchair, into a pond at Vale Gardens 2 years ago because she had become a burden to him. Mount Gambier's famous Blue Lake has been formally recognised by its traditional Bontic name for the first time. A new sign with the word Warwar was unveiled at the Blue Lake Pumping Station entry yesterday. Four artworks depicting Bontic culture were also unveiled inside the station, which until now had only documented European heritage. And lastly, festivities for South Australia's Country Music Festival start today with a morning tea in Cobb Dougla. Artists from across Australia will be travelling to the Riverland to perform, and accommodation around Barmera has been booked out by tourists so far. There'll be more news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks so much for that, Suweba. This is the Country Hour. It's 25 minutes to 1, and we are broadcasting live from about as far down the River Murray as you can possibly get. Now, when I did a broadcast this time last week, it was about 27 degrees. But we'll head to the Weather Bureau now. We're joined by Vince Rollins. Hi, Vince.
Hello, Cassie. Hello, Prue.
Hello, Vince. How are you going?
I think it's good. Is it about 16, 15 degrees here? It could be even colder.
Yeah, it might even be a touch cooler. It's sitting around 15 at the moment in Adelaide, so without having the High Marsh Island obs in front of me, I would suggest it's probably sitting around the same, maybe a touch cooler down at Goolwa. It's pretty cloudy down there, so you wouldn't expect the temperature to be too high at the moment. And it's pretty similar conditions right across the state, much cooler temperatures than average for this time of year, but we are getting pretty close to winter, so those averages will drop a little bit once we get into June. But yeah, it's with the cloud cover, it probably feels a bit cooler as well, and with a southerly airstream. But we did start out pretty cold over some parts of the state this morning. It looks like the coldest temperatures are in the west and northwest of the state. We got down to 0.6 degrees at Woodna today, 1.2 at Tarcoola, and 2 degrees at Annabella. So, yeah, some pretty cold temperatures out in the west. We are expecting those cool overnight temperatures to continue and probably right through the whole forecast period, particularly in the northwest of the state over the next few mornings. And as we get into early next week, we are expecting to see those cooler temperatures extend over northern parts of Eyre Peninsula and around the eastern districts. Probably still see some pretty cold temperatures elsewhere, but when we're talking about getting down to the sort of 2 degrees around zero and possibly even getting into the negatives early next week as we see some pretty clear skies and pretty light winds as well. But at the moment, we've got a high pressure system sitting well south of the Bight, and it's directing a south to southeasterly airstream over the state. So I've got a little bit of shower activity just around, mainly around coastal fringes today. Tomorrow we'll probably see pretty similar conditions, maybe a little bit of an increase in some shower activity around the southern slopes of the Mount Lofty ranges and the eastern coastal fringes of Eyre Peninsula, just as we get those winds going a little bit more southeast to easterly. And that's just ahead of a frontal feature that is going to move across the far south of the state during Sunday. That is going to increase the shower activity a little bit and bring some cooler temperatures behind it. And there's also a chance we could see a little bit of thunderstorm activity around the far south of the lower southeast district during that Sunday period. Once that front moves through, we see another high pressure system moving into a position south of the bight again, so we go back into that southerly airstream, bringing some colder conditions. So we will see maximum temperatures drop a little bit from probably Tuesday through Wednesday, so getting into probably the low teens in some places. And we will see showers starting to ease a little bit and contract southwards as we get a bit of that drier, cold air pushing up. But as I said, some pretty cold mornings, so we have got, we are expecting some significant frost during that Tuesday morning and possibly into Wednesday as well. But by the time we get to sort of the latter part of the week, Thursday, Friday, it's really not much happening as far as shower activity goes. So it's mainly fine conditions across the state. Now, we could see a little bit of fog around the agricultural area over the next few mornings as well. Probably just a little bit of patchiness, but yeah, it could be some around, particularly over sort of Eyre Peninsula and the west coast over the next few mornings. Now, rainfall figures, not expecting a lot of rainfall over the southern parts of the state over the next few days. As I said, probably see the more frequent and significant falls falling on Sunday, but even then we're not expecting too much. So generally looking at less than 2 millimetres over most parts of the agricultural area. Could get some falls of 2 to 5 millimetres around the parts of the southern agricultural area, mainly around coasts and ranges. A slight chance we could get some falls, perhaps up to 5 to 10 millimetres about the lower southeast, but that's a fairly small area, I think. Not expecting too much rainfall at all. So really the focus is some showers over the next couple of days, some pretty cold mornings, some pretty cold days, and then some frost and fog around with an increase in likely frosts from early next week.
Vince, I'm sitting here with my possum fur socks and my alpaca scarf down at Goolwa. I won't put them away over the next couple of weeks in that case.
No, it's definitely a pretty cool start to winter, that's for sure. And get those sort of typical winter mornings where we see some light winds, clear skies and pretty cold conditions. So you have to get used to it for at least the next week.
Mm-hmm. But not an awful lot of rain around either, by the looks.
No, it's not looking that way. Not looking that great as far as rainfall goes anywhere, but really the sort of coastal and hills parts of the southern agricultural area. So, it's not looking that great as we sort of progress into next week with that sort of high pressure system sitting south of the bight, which is really dominating our weather. But there is hints of a frontal feature moving across from the west towards next weekend. So we'll keep a pretty close eye on that. But at this stage, it doesn't look like it's going to bring that much rainfall as well. So hopefully we see a little bit of a change in the pattern over the next couple of weeks and get a few more of those decent fronts moving through.
Fingers crossed. Thanks, yes. Vince. Appreciate
it. No worries.
So just looking at the Western Districts, New South Wales, weather mostly sunny, overnight temperatures falling to between 6 and 10 with daytime temperatures reaching between 16 and 19. Lower Western, so that was Upper Western, Lower Western mostly sunny, overnight temperatures falling to between 6 and 9 with daytime temperatures reaching around 17. And it is now 18 minutes to 1.
Sonia Feldhoff.
We're here in the beautiful but chilly today, Renmark. I've got to say, there is no doubt about that.
I dare say from the millennium drought situation, it's a lot better this time around. So we're not at those stark decisions.
Do you live stressed all the time, though? Because
I have children.
That feels... Yeah, well, nothing more needs to be said. But seriously, you must be quite stressed all the time about all
this. It's a constant thought, yeah. It's on your mind, definitely.
Weekdays from 3 on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
On ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill, this is the South Australian Country Hour.
It sure is. And we are out in the country today. We are live today from Goolwa, and we're part of the special series of the River Lives broadcast. But we've just got some important news coming out of the mid-north, because growers around Robertstown are fuming over Viterra's decision to close several grain sites there. Viterra has permanently closed 6 sites, which were open last year, and another 11, which have not been open for a year or more. However, the farmers around Robertstown say it's a big blow to them while they're also dealing with drought, as Lucas Forbes reports. Looks like we're not going to actually hear from the farmers around Robertstown. We'll try to bring that story to you, but it's obviously quite a big deal for that region. But we'll stay here in the Goolwa region, because there's a lot of farming that takes place down here. As we've been touching on, there's a broad variety of industries. And Kim McHugh has been farming in the region for many years, and he joins us now. Hi, Kim.
Hi, good afternoon.
So you'd consider yourself a dairy farmer?
A dairy farmer. We've diversified a bit into cropping and beef cattle and prime lambs, but...
That's your main business.
Traditionally a dairy farmer, yeah.
And this region used to be full of dairy farmers. What's changed?
There were. There were dairy farms all over the place, and if you drive around the Fluria Peninsula, you see disused little dairies on corners of roads all over the place. So I guess what's changed? Well, we've had to become more efficient. There's a lot of work in dairy farming and not a lot of return at times. And when we go through a year like this one where feed has been at a premium and the cost of feeding cows. So I guess over the decades we've seen that dairy farms, the ones that remain, get bigger. So a lot have left the industry. So it's because of cost of production and also returns that we're getting for our milk.
I remember there were quite a number of dairy farms before the Millennium Drought, and then that really knocked the socks off the industry down here, didn't it?
Yeah. Yep. There's been a real readjustment, but it is still a very good industry, and our farmers produce the best, cleanest, greenest product from our lovely environment. There's lots of young people involved in dairying, and we want to see a future for them. So the intergenerational farms, there's lots of those around, and we need to have a viable dairy industry in this state.
And I think I heard recently that South Australia's seen an uptick in milk production, whereas other states are going down. As you're saying, this state is quite a good dairy-producing state, and people are interested in doing it here. But we're obviously in another dry period. Are farmers looking at again, seeing whether the dairying is still viable for them?
Yeah, I think there is another readjustment happening. Some have left the industry. Not a lot, but some have. And I guess it's just because of the cost of production and the small returns they've been getting for their product.
It's a national issue, isn't it? And it's affecting this area as well, obviously.
Yeah. Mm. There are some signs that the opening prices will be better come the next financial year. And there is a growing demand for our product. And there's a great opportunity to export more of our product to Asia nearby and our traditional markets. So
tell us about your business, your particular dairying operation.
We milk 300 cows, Jersey cows. They're the nice fawny ones with the big eyelashes.
The pretty ones.
Yeah. So... But majority of herds around are Holsteins, Frisians. But I've got fortunate to have two sons home on the farm and five grandsons on the farm as well that are still going to school. But obviously, they all want to be farmers. So,
do they want to be dairy farmers? Do they like
They like tractors and stuff.
Yeah, but do they like the early mornings?
Yeah, we're still to qualify them on that, but it'd be nice if a couple of those carried on the tradition. I've been there all my life. My wife plays a big role in the family business as well, bookwork and rearing calves and those sorts of things. So I think there's a future, but it's hard yakka.
And speaking of hard yakka, we've been talking recently about the River Murray allocation, that it's at 22% for the coming water year. What impact does that have on you down here at the lower end of the Murray?
It has an impact on our irrigators. the dairy farmers on the Fleurieu Peninsula don't irrigate from the River Murray. Mm-hmm. It's further up the river around Murray Bridge and Jervois, that area. They irrigate from the river. So, yeah, of course it has an impact, but I see the Murray-Darling Basin as one community and made up of a lot of little towns and families, and so we want the whole basin to be viable. We want the environment to be healthy, and we need to have irrigated agriculture as well. So it's about the balance, getting the balance right. Obviously, dry years don't help at all. If we get 10% less rain, we probably get 20% less runoff into the river systems. So, yep, we need to keep praying for rain. We need to maintain the Murray-Darling Basin plan and maybe fine-tune it, but it would be a disaster to scrap it because it took so long to get all the parties together to agree to it. And it's a confidence thing. If there's the environment's good, the river's running well, keeping the mouth open, dumping all that salt that comes down the system each year out into the sea where it belongs, it gives people confidence, just like recent rains have done. And you talk about it being a bit cold down here today. It's beautiful.
How is your place looking? Have you had decent rain?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, we've had some good rains, and after a long time of it being very dry, and I've probably never seen the country so as bare as it was before the rains came.
Really?
Yeah.
Even going back to sort of 2009, 2010?
Yeah, I think it's just been a really, really dry period, and there was no subsoil moisture left from last year.
And it's been so warm too.
Yeah, those few hot days and feed shortages, like hay, and hay in particular has been a real premium. And with dairy cows in particular, you've got to fully feed them. So the farmers were putting a lot of money into buying hay and silage and grain to keep their cows well fed so that the production remained up.
And you were mayor of this community through the Millennium Drought, and it's now 10-odd years now or down the track from that. Do you think the community has learned and adapted well to a drying climate?
I think they're very conscious of what's happening and adapting to it. We still haven't fully recovered from those 10 years. 1,000 boats left this area, so it affected business, affected tourism. And then, of course, people like the Grundys didn't have fresh water for their stock. A lot of dairies left the Narang Peninsula because they couldn't get fresh water for their stock. So a lot of infrastructure's been put in to bring water to different areas and to different communities. But, yeah, people are very, very aware of the vulnerability of the economy down here with regard to the weather, basically.
Actually, Colin was telling me before we did the interview that he lost a lot of stock to drinking salt water.
Yeah.
And I guess he wouldn't have been alone in that.
Yeah. Yep, he lost stock, and others did, and others had to go out of dairying because you've got to give cows fresh water. The guys with vineyards couldn't irrigate from the lake any more because of the water got too salty. They extended their channels initially, but then the water got too salty, so they couldn't irrigate. But just to see what happened to the environment, we talked about the acid sulfate soils, but there was tube worms that grew in that salt water that affected and got onto the freshwater tortoises.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah.
And actually, shocking. Colin was talking about those as well.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Mm. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join us here today as part of the River Lives. You've certainly been a part of the river for a long time. That was Kim McHugh, who is a dairy farmer in this region. And we're going to try and bring you the Viterra story that I was speaking about earlier in the program with farmers in the mid-north concerned about the level of closures. I think there's six sites that were open last year that are going to be closed and another 11 that have not been open for more than a year or so. Lucas Forbes has more on that.
A very big area just besides us.
Mm. I think what they don't realise as well, especially in the better years...
It all started with a text. Emu Downs farmer Aaron Neems put the word out for the farmers around Robertstown to meet at the local silos to talk about what to do about the site's closure. The next day, about 20 drought-affected farmers showed up to air their grievances. Mr. Neems says the loss of the site is a big blow to them while they're in drought.
Yeah, it's just another cost we don't need right now. Like, we're all trying our best to stay afloat the best we can, so another cost on top of... Like, most of us had little or low income last year, so a cost such as this on top of a time when we are struggling to stay afloat, it really hurts. We're currently paying $18 a tonne to have our grain taken from Robertstown delivery system to... Port Adelaide, and if we had to pay for a carrier to come cut our grain from farm to Roseworthy, it's $25 a tonne, plus a further $10 a tonne from Roseworthy to Port Adelaide. So you're looking at least $10 a tonne or more difference.
Around Robertstown, some farmers have been seeing only about a quarter of their annual rainfall. World's End farmer Simon Schmidt says the situation there is worse than anyone can remember.
The drought through this area has been the worst ever. Our rainfall records show that, and the older people in the community share that. A lot of people are really struggling, and now we've found Viterra come along saying, let's just shut the silo. It's real kick in the guts. Our only option for feed barley at the moment is to cart it to Yidunda, as what they've said with closing everything at the moment, or to Roseworthy. So it's a 4.5-hour trip back down and back and unload down to Roseworthy, or take it to Yidunda. That you can open a bagging door on the back of a semi, and that's how fast the auger works. So you might get one or two loads in at Yidunda as well. So it's really, that's why I'm talking, it's backwards. Like, we're going backwards trying to get rid of our grain. We could get rid of our grain here within 20 minutes, and now we're going to 4.5 hours.
Neil's flat farmer Andrew Heidrick says the closure means he and others will be severely impacted when the rains finally return.
The good years are going to come again, and there's more and more people. We're getting better farmers. We're supposed to be growing better, grow better crops when we do get rain. Well, where are they going to store it? I just can't work them out.
Mr. Schmidt says it's not just the farmers that are affected either. He's worried with more trucks travelling further on the roads, someone could be hurt.
We've got to voice our concerns to put it out there for the public to hear and Viterra, because we've got perfectly good facilities here to cart grain to, and they're expecting me to do another 4.5 hours each trip to cart a load of grain. That's significantly in our daily and our schedule of trying to do our harvest is huge, let alone the on the road with the truck. On the deteriorating roads, and it's not only the trucks that are on the roads, it's the families that we're passing, and the families that are probably getting impatient when we're driving with the trucks loaded that want to overtake. Who's going to be liable for these people, and who's going to be liable for when a death happens?
Mr. Schmidt says he wants to send a message to Viterra and says farmers should be considering boycotting Viterra and working with their competitor, AWB.
We got to fight for it. We've got to fight for the Yidunda site to be kept open and functioning, because if they're closing this, they're closing the bunkers out at Yidunda and just going to run the silo set up. They're going to be knocking on the door to shut that within a year or two, and we'll have nothing. I really hope people wake up and go, well, if we're going to cart to Roseworthy, let's cart to Malalar and cart to AWB, and let's boycott them. Let's make them hurt. We don't have to sell them our grain too. We can always sell to the other buyers and let them know that we're not happy.
Is that practical for many farmers to boycott Viterra? They do have a pretty large percentage of the market here in South Australia.
Well, they're not leaving us many options left to cart to, though. There's only going to be a couple options, and Malalar's not that far out of the way where AWB is.
That was World's End farmer Simon Schmidt ending that report from Lucas Forbes. There were six sites opened last year that won't open in the 2019-2020 harvest and won't play a future role in the Viterra network. But based on the five-year average, these sites represent less than 2% of total receivals. So Viterra is focusing on its larger sites and has communicated directly with growers. That's all we have time for in the program. But Prue, just quickly, there's a big landline program this Sunday.
It is. It's a great big landline program, all looking at this sort of battlefield between farmers and vegan activists. So watch 12:30 Sunday.
That's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.